Good evening. Welcome. First, a couple of minor pieces of business. I want to announce that there are books for sale in the back by these wonderful writers. Please take advantage of that opportunity. And second, I've also been asked to remind everyone that the area outside this room is a designated quiet area in the library. So when you leave here, please tiptoe through and wait until you get outside to scream out how wonderful the reading was. Now, the real business. I believe I speak for all of us on the MFA faculty when I say there are many different kinds of rewards that come with the teaching of creative writing. One of the most obvious, regardless of genre, is to see a developing writer take clear and significant steps forward in the craft. That kind of reward is rooted in the present, and it's the kind we see a lot of. More rare is the reward that comes not immediately, but in a future we hoped would eventually arrive. That's the reward of reconnecting with a student writer years later, long after the term student no longer applies. It's the reward of seeing how someone who once sat in our classrooms has continued to grow, to evolve, to mature as a writer. Tonight, we're delighted to bring back four of our program's graduates: Rosalind Elliott, Nathan Long, Amelia Phillips, and Michelle Youngstone. Writers who have made and will continue to make their mark in the world. I'm not up here to introduce them. That task they will handle among themselves. I'm simply here to thank you all for coming here for this very special event and to say that we're proud of the path that these four have carved for themselves through the literary landscape. So please join me now in welcoming them home.
Hi, good evening. I am Michelle Youngstone, and I have the honor tonight of introducing Rosalind Elliott. Rosalind is the author of four poetry chapbooks: Ghost of the Eye, Animals Usher Us to Grace, At the Center, and The Separation of Kin. Her essays and poems have appeared in New Letters, Diode, Streetlight Magazine, The Florida Review, and many other publications. She is the poetry editor at Streetlight Magazine. She has taught at VCU, PVCC, Reynolds Community College, Writer House, and the Visual Arts Center of Richmond. It is my honor to introduce Rosalind. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for coming out tonight, and thank you for everyone who made this event possible. I know it was a lot of people. I'm going to read a little bit out of older chapbooks, but most of the poems come from the most recent one, which is what I'll read first. Notes holding us tight to the world. Live in the pause between inhale and exhale, between fronds of an asparagus fern with its one red berry. A single muscle cell of the heart beats alone, little solitary god in a laboratory dish waiting for another of its kind to thump in synchrony until the small rooms pulsate aflame, continuous and steady, a star in the blue-black sky. In deep sleep, the heart flips an extra beat into the cosmos, then another and another, beginning an endless journey of lives, chanting overlapped notes, their feet drumming an old path above the river's low hymn, footprint into footprint, imperfect time. Next poem is the title poem of this chapbook, the most recent one, Ghost of the Eye. Tonight, flying home at dusk, among a bevy of souls in this long bullet bucking the jet stream. We pass through soft pink lavender sunset. I turn my head quickly to the right and catch for a second the long remaining tail of yellow light left over from the flare inside my eye last year. Oh, life, carry us through our flashes of astonishment without harm. Hurtling across firmament, faith stretched across fabric of space, we enter a gray mist, so like a thin specter, a certain coolness comes to the skin, to the mood. But then I see that old companion, brown shadow in the left periphery, sometimes a small brown dog lifting onto its hind feet, pawing the air, now a long, languid cloud promising rain. Well, it's February 1st, but it's a little leftover January. It's called January Bite. 5 days to go in this steel trap. Even succumbing to sleep changes nothing. You argue that endless conversation. Why? Why didn't you? Snow solid on the ground, hot soup in the pot. But when called to dinner, no one speaks around the table. Next day, the sun hangs slack-jawed overhead, and don't forget, comes out of the snowman's mouth. 5 days, you hold on until the moon squanders its haze, until the check arrives. It's titled, Crows Along the River Trail. We walk on sand left by the flood, step over rivulets from the weeping cliff. Deep in the woods, 5 caws begin. On the opposite bank, 3 caws reply. White blackberry blossoms arc beside us. We trample leaves of lily rinsed with mud. 4 caws respond from the woods. We don't know the code, but we know the flood rose at night. Quickly, a breathless runner pounding from behind, cracking branches, pulling a full-grown hickory into its churn. Black water swept wrens in their nests downstream. Rapids stood on their haunches and roared. The crows were silent until morning. This one is called 5 a.m. After Rain. This is an elegy I wrote a few years ago for my brother-in-law, Jamie Tift, when he passed away. 5 a.m. after rain and lightning, waking to a wet world on Tug Hill, where birds in the pines wait like poems to be written, and the morning glory waits for daybreak, already wound in the latticework of Mother's deck, helpless to do anything but open when light cracks over vetch and goldenrod. Funeral yesterday of a complicated man, his young sons dismayed and quiet in their chairs along the wall. September is not a bad time to die. After summer's debauchery, a late glory just before trees flame, with highland mist and morning still insisting the blossoms open. September, here on the edge of wilderness, where crickets hark in a chorus only grass can comprehend. Down at the pond, the geese are thinking about leaving, and not long to come, frost, shredded bind, and the rabbits scream under a hungry fox as the world goes into its tender hush before snow. Someone whispers, "Don't die yet, we still have work to do." But who was that, walking fast, head disappearing below the hill's crest? Purple dawn climbs past the tree line. Fog rides the meadow's dip. The boys are asleep under their comforter, and behind clouds, stars burn holes in the sky, and dreams fall out of heaven, whether we finish the work or not. This next one is an elegy for my dad. He passed away in my last semester of the MFA program, and then I wrote this a number of years later. From the apple tree, if on the day our father died, he remembered the apple tree like I remember the roar of its blossoms after every rain when they were wet with light. If before dying our father watched honeybees tasting nectar and broke with his thick farmer's hands a bouquet of twigs and blooms that wept as he carried them to the house and placed them in our mother's grasp. If he felt her fingers chapped with work and cold close over his as their eyes met. If he turned away to resume his chores as fragrance filled the whole house and the sky over the farm turned smoky blue. If at the edge of the waiting woods where the willows had woven themselves together, he parted the branches and stepped inside. Does he listen now from his infinite space for wind to stir in the apple tree, for fruit to fall in a hush of leaves? Does he long for us as we long for an hour? Can he see us through his long gaze, living our lives, chattering through fog, etching our tracks year after year upon the world? For the last 2 or 3 years, I've been working on some poems that have to do with houses and the people who live in them or used to live in them. And so this is a new poem, relatively new. I think I decided it was finished. And it's called A Story for My Grandson Arthur. Long before we imagined the light of your face, your father lived in a house so old and ill-repaired, a tree emerged into the living room between the floorboards and the wall. The house was on Cherry Street. The tree, a young cherry, grasping for its life. Perhaps the sound of voices drew its gangly branches up into the room. It climbed, this little twig, gaining strength and girth each month. A sapling, its delicate leaves clung along the wall. There are quiet agreements between houses and the people who inhabit them. Your father and his roommates let it grow, admired this fellow upstart trying to find its way. Its roots must have been tenacious, lucky. But that time-worn house saw many tenants, and houses empty and refill. They cannot choose what lives within their walls, nor choose who goes, who stays, or which trees will brush the window, which will venture in. Thank you very much. Thank you. So now it's my pleasure to introduce Nathan Long. Nathan Long lives in Philadelphia and teaches creative writing and literature at Stockton University. His fiction and essays appear in over 100 publications, including Tin House, Glimmer Train, Story Quarterly, and Crab Orchard Review. His collection of flash fiction, The Origin of Doubt, will be released in March 2018 by Press 53. He is currently seeking publication for his new collection, Everything Merges with the Night. Thank you so much for coming, Nathan.
Good evening. How is everybody doing? Thank you so much, Yoselyn, and thank you, Clint, for this wonderful introduction. I didn't get a chance to study with you, but I could tell from the introduction that you'd be a great teacher. And I also want to thank Tom Dodaro. I knew he couldn't be here because he's ill, but I've known him as a good friend for the last 20 years, so I miss seeing him tonight. And lastly, I just want to thank the MFA faculty and the whole program because it was such a great experience. And those of you who are in the program now, I hope you feel the same. If feel very fortunate, and it felt like it really prepared me to continue with a life of writing and also be part of a academic world. I particularly want to thank my advisor, Tom DeHaven, who's, I guess, just recovering from back surgery, so I hope that goes well. And I'm particularly excited because even though my book is supposed to come out in March, I actually got copies of it 2 days ago in the mail. So this is the first reading from the book, and in celebration, I'm going to have them for $2 off in the back if you're interested. It's 50 flash fictions, so it ends up being less than 25 cents a piece. So if you don't like one, you can go in and try another. I'm going to read, they're pretty short pieces. It's The Origin of Doubt, and it's dedicated to those who don't quite fit in. I'm going to read 6 pieces. The first one is actually a story based about Richmond, Virginia, something that happened here in Richmond, and a piece that started as a poem that Greg Donovan actually helped me with and made it better. It probably needs more work. And then the last 5 will be about sort of different realms of relationships. So I tried to kind of come up with a theme. But they're short enough that I can still get this under 15 minutes, I think. So this first piece is called Reconstruction. The couple was excited to remodel their old Victorian, which they had bought for a song. It just strikes me we have a connection here of the houses as well. Until tearing down the old kitchen wall, they discovered the remains of a body. No flesh was left, only bones wrapped in dress, a wig, and pantyhose. The police arrived and photographed everything. They said the clothes were from the 30s, when nylons were still new. Then beneath the wig, they found a fractured skull and considered the case was likely homicide. The morning paper headlined, "Unknown woman murdered 70 years ago." But after the coroner's report, the afternoon edition corrected the error. 1930s victim was a man in a dress. Cars drove by the house to get a glimpse. The couple drew the curtains and sat alone in the living room, wondering what now could restore their house to beauty. This is these 5 stories kind of about relationships are going to go from youth to old age. This first one goes out to a dear friend of mine who couldn't be here, at least in the room, who has been doing some amazing performance recently. Perhaps you saw them. My friend The Moon, who was recently eclipsed in full and blue and blood. So this is a story to, it's called When the Moon Closes Its Eyes. We were 15, the only boys in school with long hair. We went to rock concerts in the city, tagging along with your older brother and his friends. In evenings after dinner, we'd hang out down by the stream in the woods, where the lights from the line of suburban homes seemed like a dull and deadening glow. Here, the air was sharp. It burned our skin in late autumn, and we huddled close to light our first cigarette and then our first joint. The heat and smoke of the leaves on fire tasted raw and wild and free. I watched my breath, full of smoke, snake out of my lips and dissipate into the cold night air like a trace of myself offered to the world. I watched the wind wipe it away. I watched you breathing out the curled lines of smoke through the thin new hairs on your face. I imagined you were an untamed dragon. We leaned against the gigantic sycamore, watching the moon rise through leafless trees, listening for raccoon and fox hunting in the night. We passed the burning ember back and forth, a torch to awaken us. I felt your smoke-stained fingers offering it to me, and I watched your lips draw in the fire. I wanted to be you. I wanted to kiss you. I wanted us to merge into one thing, like the water in the stream beside us. I took your hand, we traced each other's fingers, my heart ran through the forest, and the moon closed its eyes briefly behind a cloud. We never returned to the woods. All the wild animals have scurried. And now, here in this car alone, overlooking our old neighborhood. My cigarette burns down to my fingers and smells like ash. And this is called Alignment. We lived in the same neighborhoods, biked the same streets, went to the same potlucks at the same collective houses. What they remember of summer nights is drinking beer, the front porches, as joints floated through the air like fireflies, kissing each person's lips. And talk of Rilke and Descartes until dawn, and then walking home in the rain. Then autumn came. They pulled out old gray sweaters from their closets. They biked with coats and scarves. Evenings became large bottles of wine and steaming kitchens, fresh bread from the oven. Everyone sitting on the floor, mismatched plates in their laps, the house dog meandering through the crowd like a hostess looking for scraps. One night near solstice, a few stayed up late, improvising an epic poem in rhyme. One by one, they fell asleep, on the sofa, curled up on the rug, against each other's bodies. The candles burned out, the night grew dark. Then the moon snuck in. It brushed across three faces, the way a moth might glide past your arm. Each woke to the light, and without a word, they began to kiss each other. They had never seen each other in this light before. They kissed and kissed as the moon trailed across their faces. It was like drinking milk from a distant planet. Then their portion of the room grew dark, they grew tired, and with fingers interlocked, they fell asleep. And later, when the moonlight slid across the dog's face, it woke and sighed a moment, then curled back up and closed its eyes. And this is a really short piece. It's called Fireflies. For some reason, I got into writing 59-word stories. And I want to thank Mary Boys for publishing this years ago in the Tusculum Review. Fireflies. At 19, he loved Michael, who had made them two flashlights that blinked in a special pattern, like fireflies. "So we can find each other in the dark," Michael had said. But they had since broken up. Years had passed. They moved to different cities in different states. He became a teacher and Michael a pilot. Still, on nights when planes flew overhead, he turned the flashlight on and pointed it towards the sky. This story, one of the great tragedies that happened, in November of last year, besides the unmentioned one, is that Leonard Cohen passed away. And so this is a story inspired by one of his songs. You might be able to figure it out. Leanna. Leanna feeds me cinnamon cookies, a recipe she said came from her Russian grandmother. We drink gunpowder tea from a large green bowl with 1,000 cracks in its surface of the glaze and sit on the floor as the sun is setting. We lean against pillows she has bought from Goodwill. The steam from the bowl smells like smoke as it rises up through the darkening evening, and a short blue candle perched on the top of a clear bottle seems to give off more and more light. We've just come from the dock outside, where the river lapped loudly against the wooden piers, and the trees seemed to bend as softly as seaweed in the wind as it came down from the mountains in deep breaths. We were wrapped only in wool blankets, heavy and gray, and the cool air slid down our bodies as she lifted her hand and pointed to an uncertain place on the surface of the water where a ship had once sunk. It had been full of sleeping sailors waiting for their leave at shore, and on the far bank, she told me, there had been a missionary camp where the children used to climb the wide oak tree and drop from its limbs into the water, back when the river was clean and still. Now, in the room full of candles, the blankets still around us, she looks away while touching the corner of the table beside her, like it is an ear or a nipple, and she says, "I can hold my own." I nod, I don't know what she means, or else I do, and I never doubted it until now that she has said it, which seems to make it untrue. I used to think, she said, that my heart was a clay pigeon made to be broken. And now, I ask, lifting the bowl to my mouth, the steam rising warm on the skin of my face. Now, she says, I feel like it's a pie meant to be eaten. I want the tea to burn my tongue or my mouth just a little. I want to feel some deep hurt. I see how a strand of her hair has curled from being wrapped around her finger, and I think that it seems like her future, repeating itself but projecting outward, forward, so that she imagines it is going someplace entirely new. The blanket she is wearing is draped open, and when she laughs, as she takes a bite of cookie, the crumbs fly out from her mouth and land on the small ledge of her belly. I stare at the crumbs and the hairs on her stomach, and I wonder what in the world is not loss or desire. The last piece is called That Long Evening on Our Balcony. Gabriella and I are throwing words off our balcony, watching them spin like maple seedlings or drop like pears and then split open on the sidewalk. Sometimes a letter separates in mid-air, turning mugs into mug, the S floating freely by itself until it catches the front of the word, changing it into smug, a split second before it landed on the ground and shatters into gibberish. Two little girls were playing hopscotch nearby, and we threw them daffodils and candies. To the man who once spit on our hedge, we drop ink. The three letters soak into his hat, and he looks up bewildered. Gabriella and I drink gin and tea, a concoction her grandmother passed on to her, her secret recipe for surviving long hours of afternoon bridge parties. Her grandmother would always bring a flask mixed with gin and a milk which would not curdle no matter what the proof, and claim it was her special creamer. Here today we use only a drab of gin, but it takes to us. We pour ourselves another cup and salute Gabriella's grandmother, then drop cream over our balcony rail and watch the white letters of the word spill into the grasses. Next, I throw over the word rupture, and we laugh as we watch it do just that on the concrete. The sun slips behind clouds, then buildings, then the immense curvature of the earth. And all is orange and warm, as if only now to reveal that sun is truly made of fire. I look at Gabriella and see her nose and cheeks glowing crimson and wonder if it is the sunlight or the tea that makes her shine. She stands and laughs aloud. Then, without letting me see it, she tosses a word over the balcony she has hidden in the pocket of her house dress. What is it? What is it, I ask, bending over the rail to read the twirling thing. I should be able to make it out, for as it falls, it grows larger and larger and longer, but I can't. And then, just before the word lands, it straightens out for a moment, and I manage to read it. Century, it says, then splinters into 100 pieces. We've lost a whole century, I cry, and look up at Gabriella, only to see that she has grown quite old. The teapot and cups are empty. The flask is dry. Then I feel it in my own bones, a wrinkled, crippling force, like gravity exponentialized. Gabriella begins to shiver. The sunlight is all but gone. Come on, I say to her. It's time to go inside. Thank you. I also want to put a shout out to Laura Holliday, who helped me on an earlier revision of this book, so thank you. So next up is Amelia Phillips. She is the author of three poetry collections from the University of Akron Press, Signaletics, which I love the title of, Groundspeed, and the forthcoming Empty Cup. Her poems and lyric essays have appeared widely in literary publications, including Agni, Boston Review, Plowshares, Poetry, and elsewhere. She has twice traveled to outer space, and she's an assistant professor in the MFA writing program and Department of English at the University of North Carolina in Greensboro. So please welcome Amelia Phillips.
Hi everyone, how's it going? I wanted to first of all thank Tom Dodato for doing all the work that he does, and to the fellow readers, it's such an honor to read with you all, and to all of you here in the audience, especially the current MFAs, thank you for being here. I also want to say thank you to Greg, Kathy, and David, who were all my three MFA teachers, and it's such a pleasure to come back and read in their presence. I'm just going to jump right in. I'm going to read some poems that are from my forthcoming book, Empty Clip, that's coming out technically in April, but I'm supposed to get copies on Monday. So this will also be my first reading from it, although it's still, you know, printer paper, so it's not as exciting. The book is exploring different kinds of violences, particularly gun violence, sexual violence, and domestic violence. The first poem that I'm going to read is a poem based off of an event that happened while I was living in New Jersey, and something I got to witness in my neighborhood. I'm not going to say it's a fortunate event. It's called To the Neighbor Boy with His Father's Hunting Rifle Begging the Police to Shoot. Your name is an empty clip that local news wants to load with rumors of substance abuse. Disturbed, next door says over the fence as he pushes his mower into the shed after the borough's door-to-door order to stay in. The streets went dark first with SWAT, their helmets sunglossed to mirror. They looked bored this far down, kicking dirt and wiping palm sweat on the Kevlar over their hearts. Later, something else rolled in, not dark exactly. It was still afternoon, and I walked out on my porch but wasn't turned back. I heard you, faint and guttered to nonsense by the hot wind, but I couldn't see you. Blocked by vans, I watched instead the tree in your parents' yard sway, turning out its leaves like wrists, the air a hiss with radios, and still no black clouds, no dark rain. So today at UNCG, when I was not on campus, they held a mass casualty exercise on campus, and so they closed down a good portion of campus, and law enforcement from the state agencies and the UNCG police reacted as if they were reacting to a shooter. When I was in New Jersey at the job I was at, we had a really sensational active shooter presentation in which the head of our campus security basically said, "You're on your own," but did so with a PowerPoint presentation that had really bad graphics and sound effects. And so I was really disturbed after this, and I sort of hesitate to read it here, but I'm going to go ahead and go for it. This is called Campus Shooter PowerPoint and Information Session. The font, chiller, blood dripping, its unbodily red meant to impress spectacular consequence. Modeling projection, eye on you, through projection, light on surface. The point-blank image focused on the barrel blurred cameo-like at the edges. They mean, they say, to give us a plan, a route, procedure, a way out, but the fuck of the FX as bullet holes animate over the text causes the prof next to me to flinch, startled away from his words with friends bore. A siren tsunami's now out of the PA, its crackle and hiss legionous as it drowns out the security chief's voice, who keeps on talking, so I must strain to hear his litany of stats. A retired cop, like my father, who has the same stiff casualness of someone pretending they're not on guard while they say they are always on guard. I think of my father's lapses in small talk when we entered my grandmother's favorite restaurant while he scanned the room pretending to look for a waiter or bathroom as he swept every face at every table for anyone he ever arrested or testified against. Videos now, first hands from Umpqua and Virginia Tech, and so on, and this subliminal with tense shifts, the scroll of campuses in red on black moving so fast it's illegible. But I tried to read at least one, the so on accurate in its imprecision, its inability to witness in full. If a shooter enters your classroom, there's nothing I can do, he says, loosening his tie. But I can help the classroom next door, maybe. an aerial of our campus, a handgun moving in a translucent corona of red from one building where I teach to another where my office is. My father sat outside my first job in his unmarked car whenever I closed and would only leave when he saw me locking up. He never told me, never waved, sat in shadow. How I thought the so on then might be an urging of instinct, of will, and I'll keep you safe even if you wrench away. But now when the chief says, we really don't know what could happen, and so we don't have a set script, the so on seems to take shape after shape after shape, the way we are always moving into all the bodies we have and are in our lives, the so on in the day-to-day scope playing dead, but its pulse quick, animal, alive. I'm going to read maybe a slightly lighter bump. When I was in college, I worked at a Starbucks for 3 years, and I've suddenly started writing all these Starbucks poems, which feels sort of goofy, but this is one about, we had this regular, and hopefully this is implicit in the poem, but I did want to just preface it. I had this one regular who kept asking me out on dates, and he would come in at night, and I was the night supervisor. And he ordered iced tea every night, and so he drank lots of iced tea, like, all the time. And then he got kidney stones from drinking all this iced tea, and he brought those to me to try to convince me that I should go out with him. It's called Barista. Andrew, an evening regular, rattled the mint tin he presented from his pocket like a carrot promise, or faith in the face of doubt, and set it on the counter where I counted tills, replacing payday 20s for coin rolls and lower denominations. I did this for you, he said. Herod Antipas to my oblivious Salome. He asked me to open the box, and so I do. The chalk white burrs, 4, from pencil eraser to the size of a sugar cube. Kidney stones. Of course, my coworkers' voices slur on the headset. Amelia, I want to show you where these passed. But I'm only a server then. A junior in college who's learned less about saying no than how to seduce bills into the tip jar from men's wallets that smell animal, like horse, like a saddle. He looked expectant. His eyes always reflective, as if he were crying but not letting go of the salt. The way one fragments reassigns part of one's own body to become the body of the lover one desires but cannot have in a room alone tonight, window open, not so much with a distance between them but within that distance, which is amnesiac as horizon and blue in the way we say water is blue, although it has no color except in its depths. I wanted to say yes, then, if only so that our humiliation was complicit, a coat in which we each had an arm. My boss leaned his shoulder into mine and whispered, is this guy bothering you? But the sun was setting, and the milk hissing under the steam wands like a white mouse with fangs set in. And there is no other devotion as real as separateness. I tossed off a joke about how unhealthy I was for him, which he liked. Just months before, I'd pleaded with a tweaked-out vagrant to stop snorting the Splendas and Equals he ripped and poured out on the condiment bar. But when I asked him to leave, he said he couldn't, because I couldn't see him. He was invisible. We're not there at all, he insisted, as he started for the Sweet and Lows. I didn't see Andrew for a long time after he brought his gift, and after closing, I quietly stacked the safe full of what we'd earned and chained together the chairs on the patio, picking up cigarette butts with my bare fingers so I could smell their acridity later as I fell asleep without feeling guilty. The wind, strong from the west in warning, like all ineffable forces, gave me back my body. My belly sour, all rewind and glower, the way memory of grief has no cause, only the lyric shove that sends the ground up to us, fuming the smell of rain, ozone, grain. He spit on the sidewalk as he left. When I told him to put his ruins away and turn to get his usual, I thought I heard him say, Amelia, you will love me. And playing toward my pocket money, I said, is that a promise? I said, I already do. So the first time I ever saw a dead person was when my cousin pulled up this website called facesofdeath.com. Do you remember this? It was like mid-90s website. It was just pictures of dead people. So that's what this poem is about. It's called facesofdeath.com. Also, when you're working in a word processor and you type facesofdeath.com, it makes it a URL. And so I like curiously clicked on it, but it doesn't exist anymore, so. Facesofdeath.com. Also, this was on a early modem computer, so I tried to capture that sound. I don't know if I did it right, but facesofdeath.com. On my grandmother's PC monitor the size of a butterball turkey with its dial-up modem like Casio keyboard trumpets cut with a razor on glass, my cousin, a half year older than me, pulled up the website slow to boot. First the black background and the gallery outline of thumbnails and red links to categorize causes, car crashes, gunshots, suicides, some duplicated across tallies. The logo last to arrive, a pixelated shock font. Blood dripping or as if slashed into skin, I can't remember. We kept something else open in case someone else walked in. Cartoons on in the living room and our parents with second or third helpings. I saw the faces, hollow eyes wide, and looked for blood and looked away for blood, and looked at my cousin to realize then that he would die and that anyone could. First cousin, first friend, first person I lost touch with, now just a photo in my Facebook newsfeed. Camo and a rifle, a shotgun, a .44 with a silencer, buckshot BB, some high caliber slug. The voicemail from my stepmother. Your father's been shot. Not how, not alive or dead. I called again and again until someone, anyone, picked up. An accident. He did it to himself and the tourniquet. His tongue slugged by morphine, he said on the phone, I don't want this to deter you from owning a gun. He said, I'll buy you one. I said, no. I said, no. I said, I have my grandfather's service sidearm just to button up the issue. I admit I wondered what it would be like to hold the barrel between my teeth back when I was looking down the barrel of days of grief, but statistically women don't shoot themselves. I remember one victim. Was it suicide or murder? Does it matter? How the bullet grooved clean into the skin below her clavicle, a buttonhole, a baby's mouth, a window, a rose, the space into which someone goes. So I'm going to end actually with a poem from Groundspeed and wrap it up there and then introduce the lovely Michelle Youngstone. This poem is called Reading Ovid at the Plastic Surgeons. And I wrote this poem when I grabbed a book off my desk really quickly and then went to a doctor's appointment and then realized that I had grabbed Metamorphoses and was going to sit in the plastic surgeon's office to read it. Anyway, also David makes a cameo in this book. Reading Ovid at the Plastic Surgeons. No one else with a book, the slick weeklies gossip amongst themselves on the side tables as the ticker rolls the Dow Jones down, 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 under a profile of the marathon bombers, the older a boxer. Jove argues for the removal of a race of peoples that do not please him. What his past remedy calls for the surgeon's knife. He will take a hunk of my cheek, cancer. And though I can't see mid-procedure, I imagine the sight as an apricot bitten. This, a survival mechanism, romanticism. David says, if you're out in public and you don't want anyone to talk to you, bring a book of poetry. Even as I enter the confidence of the room, I avoid my reflection in the window, for there, most of all, I see myself as only I can, as only the eye will have. As light alone. Thank you. And I have the great honor of introducing Michelle Youngstone, who's the author of the novels Lost in the Beehive, which is forthcoming in April 2018, Above Us Only Sky, and the Handbook for Lightning Strike Survivors, which the Boston Globe called, quote, an exceptionally rich and sure-handed debut. She lives in the Outer Banks of North Carolina with her husband and son. So please join me in welcoming Michelle.
I'm so glad to be here and say hi to Greg Donovan. I took a poetry and fiction writing class with him back in, I think it was either 1988 or 1989. So I have 3 degrees from BCU. And Clint McCown and Tom DeHaven both helped me with my first novel, which I wrote while I was in the creative writing MFA program here, The Handbook for Lightning Strike Survivors. And my second novel, Above Us Only Sky, is available for sale. I don't have Lost in the Beehive because it's not out yet, but I made you guys all bookmarks so you can grab one of these. So about Lost in the Beehive, I actually started this book back in 2009, but my publisher, Simon & Schuster, I had a 2-book contract, and they said that they got to decide which book they published first, so they decided to publish the book I had not written. So in between, I wrote Above Us Only Sky, which I'm very proud of, and then I returned back to Lost in the Beehive, which has had like 100 different titles. So about the novel, I'm going to read actually from the second part of it, so I thought I'd give you a quick summary so you're not lost. Gloria Ritchie, the main character, is born wrong, or so she thinks she is. Growing up in the 1960s and attracted to the same sex, Gloria is sent to an institution to be cured. There, she meets a boy who will change her life forever. As Gloria tries to understand the difference between right and wrong, she encounters a host of eccentric characters, which I always have to have in all of my novels, her hard-drinking uncle, who's her mother's first love, and a dark suitor who promises her the moon. Lost in the Beehive is an unconventional love story. It's the story of one woman's quest to be true to herself, to be who she was born to be. I always have to go last, and I'm such a nervous reader, so sorry. It's that young stone. I told Tom Dodato, I'm like, I'm always going last with that whining. So part 2 of Lost in the Beehive is introduced with a quote from Jack Kerouac's On the Road. This is the story of America. Everybody's doing what they think they're supposed to do. One afternoon, I went to the shed for a trowel. The honeybees trailed, flying through the doorway, swarming the ceiling. I grabbed the gardening gloves and looked up. More came and more. There were thousands of them. Is Chef with you? I asked, expecting an answer, as odd as that sounds. I watched and waited. They gathered in a T-shaped mass that framed the rafters, and I got down on my knees, then down on my back, the gardening gloves still in hand. I waited for them to say something. Rather, they came together, a gold and amber disco ball, bees zipping out from the spinning center, then descending, not falling, but aiming, 1,000 bullets on my skin. They were going to kill me, maybe finish what they started when I was 7. But then I felt their tiny fuzzy legs, my limbs vibrating with theirs. I slipped off my sneakers as the bees crowded onto my face and neck. I wasn't afraid. We hummed together, their legs sticky on my eyelids, ascending, defying gravity. They felt like salvation. The sound had walls, tissue thin, and deep inside the cell, I saw Chef shooting his arm into the air, a rocket, the bees flying out. We had our whole lives ahead of us. He straddled my red suitcase at the New York Public Library. I shot my arm into the air, then saw that it was golden with bees. I heard a man's voice, Jacob, my husband, calling my name. The bees rose like sunlit dust. Jacob's dark boots were by my face. What the hell are you doing on the floor? I squeezed the gardening gloves and sat up. Are you all right? Did you fall? When I didn't answer, he said, I'm seriously worried about you. Maybe I wasn't all right. That was a possibility. I looked at my arms, at where the bees had been. I looked to the ceiling. They weren't there. I sat up. I'm sorry. What are you doing in here? I was getting a trowel. I showed him the gloves as though that helped explain why I had been lying on the floor of the shed. As Jacob pulled me to my feet, I looked once more for the bees. There was no sign of them. Had I imagined them? I felt caught between two worlds, one where I was special, some magical beekeeper, and another where I did what I was told. I kept the house neat, made dinner, spread my thighs as wide as they would go. I was a trapeze artist walking a tightrope. On one side, just beneath me, bubbled the oblivion of living like this forever. This angry man, never letting me forget that I was always wrong. I wasn't sure exactly when it started, when it became clear that I was no longer in control of my life, that everything, including my own happiness, depended on Jacob's happiness. One day, it just was. I think that the seeds were planted early on. Maybe I should have known that something was seriously amiss when he said that no professor could teach him anything. Maybe I should have known when he was rude to that doctor. Maybe I was so caught up with the idea of marriage and normalcy that I lost the ability to distinguish between cruelty and kindness. All I knew for certain was that 2 years into our marriage, I was sorry every day for everything. I could do nothing right. I said the wrong thing, and I looked at him the wrong way. This is funny. I was just thinking, I remember in my MFA class, fiction writing with Bill Tester, the first time we all had to share and read, and I was so nervous just at the table. I started hyperventilating, and so I've come a long way. Because I was always wrong, he shoved me. It was my fault. I shouldn't infuriate him so. Then he put his hand in my throat because I wouldn't shut up. I said the wrong thing again. He said, if you really love me, you'll stop pushing my buttons. I tried, and I failed. When I fought back, he laughed, and later he cried. Why do you make me act this way when all I want to do is love you? And some part of me believed him. Maybe I had heard him tell me too many times that I was to blame. Or maybe it was easier to believe him than fight back. And there were no bruises, not on the outside, and I was too embarrassed to tell anyone. Either way, just 2 years in, I had mastered walking on eggshells. I listened for agitation in the voice, for sarcasm. I said whatever I thought Jacob wanted to hear. I agreed with everything he said, backtracked and apologized if I upset him. I accepted responsibility for his anger. I found a good hiding spot, the shed and sometimes the pantry. I thought about leaving him, but my life, these eggshells, took on a surprising normalcy. And the more time that passed, the easier it was to keep doing what I was doing, to pretend to be someone I wasn't, to tolerate behavior that Jacob argued is perfectly normal. A man loses his temper. Just because your father's a pansy doesn't mean every man is. But then, holding my balancing stick, my feet wobbly on the tightrope, was the other side. The soft, sweet side where Betty and the bees gathered. In that spot, there was cool water and sunlight. And I could be myself there. Only I didn't think that I deserved that. Happiness. That's my reading. Thank you. And I wanted to say thank you so much to the MFA program. Of my 3 VCU degrees, my MFA is by far my very favorite one. And I wanted to thank Clint McCown and Tom DiDotto, who I'm sorry is sick, and Tom DeHaven, who was such a great force in my career here at VCU. And most of all, I wanted to thank all of you for coming out to hear us read. It's really great to have a live audience and share our writing with you. And just to say that there are books available in the back for sale, and if you'd like to buy one, we'll all be happy to sign them. And thank you so much again to my fellow readers. This was really fun.